Il-program li ser tisimaw huwa miġjublilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
Welcome to University Matters on Campus FM 103.7. I'm Patricia Cavalleri, and in this series we shall be hearing from academics about their research and from students and other members of the campus community about the many activities which will be taking place during the coming year. I'm delighted to have with me in the studio today for University Matters on Campus FM, Professor Simone Borge. Just a few words about my guest. Professor Borge read for a degree in Laws, LLD, in 1991, and a Magister Juris degree in International Law in 1994 from the University of Malta. In 2009, she obtained her PhD on the conservation of marine natural resources at the International Maritime Law Institute. Professor Borge worked for the public sector from 1991 to 2004, first as First Secretary of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and then Head of the Legal and Multilateral Affairs Section within the Ministry of the Environment. During this time, she was mainly responsible for negotiating Malta's position in international environmental multilateral agreements, the drafting of legislation and legal policy making in environmental law. She coordinated the transposition of the Environmental and Energy Acquis Communautaire during Malta's negotiations to become an EU member state. She also participated in various research projects within the European Union and the United Nations. Professor Borge served as the first chairperson to Malta's Occupational Health and Safety Authority. At present, she is the Deputy Dean of the Faculty of Laws and Head of Department of the Environmental Law and Resources Law within the same faculty of the University of Malta. She is the chairperson of the Institute on Climate Change and Sustainable Development at the University of Malta and a member of the University Senate. Professor Borge is also a visiting lecturer at the Catholic University of Leuven, the IMO's International Maritime Law Institute, and the University of Auckland in New Zealand. She's published legal books as well as many articles and papers. She's also co-chair of the Forum of European Legal Experts on Climate Change Adaptation and chair of the Platform of University Academics on Climate Change. She's currently the Ambassador for Malta on climate change issues. A warm welcome to you, Professor Borge.
Thank you to all the listeners who are currently tuned in.
From your bio, I think we've sort of generally given the idea that your main interests are environmental, legal issues and climate change. And of course, this is, to say it's a hot topic at the moment is really... Yeah, absolutely, because it's really been in the news lately. But perhaps first we can start off by discussing the role of the university in academic research and the study of climate change, because here we're not talking about it necessarily from a sort of the scientific point of view, which I have done with other members of staff. Here we're looking at the legal issues and what the university can contribute through its research to those legal parameters.
That's right. And I would say not just from the legal perspective only, I think that one of the fact that law in itself is so interdisciplinary in its approach. I mean, the law serves all faculties, all areas of research. So it was natural also for me to get a lot of the academics that work on climate change at the university to get them together, to organize ourselves in assessing what we are doing in each of our faculties, in each of our institutes, and approach the subject really from an interdisciplinary manner, because I think that is fundamental. As such, climate change is not only an environmental issue, it is a very cross-sectoral issue. It is at the very core of socioeconomics, for example, because it obviously will affect the people, or everybody, but particularly the most vulnerable people. It is also very essential to be constantly in link with scientific knowledge, scientific information, innovation, because we have to find answers and solutions to the challenges in science and technology, but also to have a constant flow of information to build a knowledge base, in particularly for Malta, as to how climate change will affect us and how can we best adapt to it. And also to be on the forefront with other countries in the European Union to really work hard on mitigating climate change, to reduce our emissions. And obviously the university plays a fundamental role in all of this, because at the end of the day, this is the main research institution of the nation, and government has to work very much, very close to the university to work its way around this particular challenge.
In fact, many of our academics are working in that area. I mean, I can think of talks I've had with Rhea Lu from physics.
That's right.
And others going back many years, in
yes,
actual fact.
That's right.
And they've all been working on the local situation, and also then working in tandem with EU projects, which then take our information then out to
That's
the wider
right.
world.
That's right.
So the university has that capacity to group people in one place.
Exactly.
In very conveniently, so that you can actually have this group
of experts which are building this knowledge base, which is fundamental. Unless you have a knowledge base, you won't be able to do anything else. So it is really a fundamental role which the university plays. In fact, we are quite a large group, and you've mentioned it when you were reading my bio, the platform of University of Malta Academics on climate change. We have, for example, Professor Brigolio from FEMA. We have also Professor Charles Samud, who's the Dean of the Faculty of Science. We've got Professor Robert Gilland, who has been working very hard on renewable energy issues from the Faculty of Engineering. There's also the Institute for Earth Systems. You have Charles Galdis there, who was Malta's main chief meteorologist for some time, and now he's joined us at university. We have a number of people that are highly involved, even from the Faculty of Education, like Paul Patch, who's running the Eco Scholar and who places a lot of focus on climate change. So we are really a huge group. Apologies for if I'm missing someone at the moment. We've also, in these recent 2 years, given the Institute, what was the Institute for Sustainable Development, we've given that institute an additional role as the institute, which will also try and steer climate change knowledge, promotion and research in the university. But I must make this clear, it doesn't mean that only the institute will be carrying out studies on climate change. That cannot happen, because each and every faculty, as I was explaining, has its own role, which cannot be replaced by any other faculty. A case in point, for example, is the Faculty for the Built Environment, Architecture and the Built Environment, that plays a fundamental role in developing the construction industry in becoming more energy efficient, for example, and no other faculty can have that role. That's one of the aspects that it can be involved in. But there are a number of issues that perhaps you have this interface between faculties, like the Faculty for Engineering and the Faculty of Science, for example. And also the Faculty of Laws that has to be there sort of to provide the guidelines, the legal guidelines, to enable the nation, our nation, to actually implement these steps that we are going through in order to fulfill our international obligations, our obligations even as a new member state, which are very hefty in reducing emissions.
What exactly are these constraints that we're looking at as far as emissions are concerned?
Well, we had to...
Without asking for exact figures,
yes,
sorry.
To give a bit of an explanation, we all know that in order to address the issue, all states have to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. And greenhouse gas emissions are generated from burning of fossil fuels. So basically, once you address your fossil fuels, you are addressing the human-induced climate change, the human-induced aspect of emitting greenhouse gases in an artificial manner in the atmosphere. And so what has happened through even the international treaty that we have, and also now with this new Paris Agreement, but if we go to the basics of the treaty, that you take 1990 as a base year, and you calculate how much you have to reduce from 1990. From your emissions in 1990. And Malta, at first, until it was a new member, didn't really have a target, because we were considered to be a developing country, and developing countries, until the Paris Agreement, had no commitment. The Paris Agreement has changed all that. But we had an obligation to take stock of our emissions, to find out how many greenhouse gases we are emitting. And in fact, it was university, the Faculty of Science, that carried out the first inventory. for the country. Obviously, it was a project with UNDP of the United Nations, and it was the Faculty of Science, in fact, that carried out this project. And then from then onwards, we also had to produce and formulate a national action plan for Malta, a national climate program. Again, it was the Faculty of Science with a number of other academics that were involved, but they coordinated it. And then after that, when we became members of the EU, then we were speaking on in more stringent terms, because then we really had to have a target to reduce. And so after considerable policy decisions that had to be taken, serious investment had to be made, to go first from coal, we went to oil, and now from oil we're switching on to gas by in these years, basically this year. It's supposed to have happened earlier, but then we had a bit of a setback. But by the year 2020, Malta would have, because of these policy-making choices that I've mentioned, would have reduced its emissions from 1990 levels by around 40%, which is a great deal.
Gosh, that sounds like an awful lot.
Exactly. We also, obviously, we can never do enough. We can also do much more in energy efficiency, for example. And obviously, again, we have targets for renewable, using renewable energy as an alternative, in the sense that it's not only at EU level, you don't have an obligation only to reduce your emissions, but also to switch as much as possible to renewable energy and generate about 10% of your energy, in the case of Malta, from renewable energy targets. We are moving ahead there. I think we've come around to about 6%, but we used to be 2%. Now, recently, although maybe these studies are not official, I've heard that the figure has gone up to around 6%. And we intend to do more. There are still some problems, basically related to the lack of space in Malta, that we have a serious problem in having very little space to allocate it for more PV panels and other forms of renewable energy. We have seen, unfortunately, what happened with the experiment with wind energy. It was a decision that was dropped because for various reasons. Hopefully, technology will make it easier and more possible to have offshore wind turbines that could be more feasible than what we were going to have. And but the realities, the geophysical realities of Malta will always remain what they are, because we have very little space. There are other options. We can also enter into partnerships with other states where we generate renewable energy. We can invest ourselves as a country. We invest, in fact, I think we have a project. The government has embarked on a project with Montenegro where it forks out the money to invest in renewable energy. And then, the renewable energy will be housed somewhere else because of this lack of space. So there are options, and you can really never do enough. Ideally, if technology permits, if we could depend on 100% renewable energy, that would be the best option. At this point in time, it's not a reality, but it doesn't mean that we cannot achieve that in a couple of years' time, in a number of decades. And what is certainly necessary is research, and obviously offering the subject to our students to specialize in, because that is how we will achieve exactly these targets.
I always see this sort of conundrum that we have to look at it in the very, very, very micro, on the sort of family unit basis, mm-hmm. and then look at it a little bit wider, perhaps to the local council basis, then look at it a little bit wider. And within that, you've got industry, you've got different stakeholders in it.
Exactly.
And even in a small island like ourselves of 400,000 people, it does potentially create tensions within.
It does.
And a lot of education is needed to work on each of those sections, I would imagine.
Exactly. In fact, you rightly so, and this brings me to the point I wanted to make. What I was mentioning was the reduction in targets. I was referring to the generation of energy from power stations. Although that required heavy investment, and it was difficult to achieve because, you know, a huge chunk of the budget went there, and it's a difficult political decision to achieve. Let's make no bones about it, you know. But in a way, it's the easiest decision to take because it's contained, it's one area, it's one source. What you are mentioning, in fact, are behavioral changes, which are much more difficult to achieve. And in fact, as you rightly said, it starts from the domestic level, how much energy we consume, that we have to become quite vigilant in how we consume energy, because we are wasteful, let's admit it. I mean, we're used to a comfortable lifestyle. After a while, perhaps if the energy prices, the energy bills go up, we might be careful for the first few weeks and months, and then we get used to it. Sometimes, to make matters worse, we install PV panels, we start having a reduction in our bill, and we start sort of to become lazy again, because we say, oh, sir, with our PV panels, you know, we're making it up for it, so we won't switch on and switch off the geyser anymore, let's leave it on, because now, you know, the bill is what it is. So it's a behavioral change, and then you go up in a staggered approach at the local level, for example, the different interests, as you mentioned, industry, transport, for example, even agriculture is a huge emitter, really. I mean, for example, few people perhaps understand that exposure of manure generates methane, which is a very, very strong greenhouse gas, much stronger. It causes much more of a greenhouse effect, I think about six times more, if I recall well, than carbon dioxide, for example. So every sector generates greenhouse gases. And this is now the second phase. This is where we still have a lot of work to do as a nation to address these sectors and make them much more carbon neutral. And this will require behavioral changes. It will require a lot of awareness building and capacity building as well, and a more energy efficient sectors. And I think it is all sectors, all stakeholders that have to be involved. And this is the reality of it all. Sometimes perhaps we make the mistake of seeing each other as enemies. For example, we think industry is the enemy of the environment. It shouldn't be that way. It should be a matter of persuading industry to become greener. That's when we will win the battle, not when we confront each other.
And when you, as a lawyer, look at what legal parameters you can put in place to create the coordinates for adapting people coming on board with these new ideas, I think that must be quite difficult, because draconian laws, I mean, one can put in, but then if you haven't done the talking, the awareness building, exactly, the friend building, exactly, and all the rest of it, that it's not really going to be...
It will backfire, it will have a rebound effect, you know, it will make governments unpopular, and, you know, elections come, and sort of the governments feel very, you know, very... nervous about that. But in reality, thankfully, we have also the EU, which acts as a safety net. You know, there are certain measures that, first of all, it helps us a lot because you gain from the experience of other states. Although I must say that we have our own realities. And one of the reasons why it's very important to have a local knowledge base is to go to the EU and say, listen, these are my geophysical realities, my economies of scale. What's good for Poland, what's good for the UK, is not going to be good for Malta. And so we have to adjust a bit the parameters, not in the sense of giving us an advantage, but in making us really and truly in a position to be at the same level, you know, with other states, that perhaps for us it's not an issue because we don't have any steel industry, for example, but we do have, and our agricultural sector, it's true that it's very small, but it is also very vulnerable, and it is also very difficult to find alternatives because of the lack of space. And sort of perhaps even certain measures that are taken because of our economies of scale won't work, and they would cause a grave disadvantage to vulnerable people, the elderly, for example, or single-income families. So in reality, it is true that as you were saying, it is very challenging to adapt a law to these particular circumstances, to these needs. We do have the advantage of having the EU discuss matters with us. We're involved in the discussions, in the negotiations, and we pan out what needs to be done. But we also have to be aware of our realities to be able to influence EU law and EU policy. And when you get, when you present papers, real solid research, the EU will listen. When you have figures and facts and the realities exposed, the EU will listen because we are a reality, we are a member state. But then we have to offer the options as well. We cannot have a holiday because we're a small state. So we have to be on the forefront. And this is where university definitely will be crucial in assisting government. When it comes to the laws, there are ways and means. For example, I was mentioning the example of methane, for example. So you'd have laws as to how you would store manure, for example, or how you would store waste which is exposed to the air, for example, because that also generates methane. One of the areas we will have to target very soon is the use of certain gases used by industry, which are actually gases related to ozone depletion, but they are also greenhouse gases. And sometimes in industry, when you have restructuring or a new industrial plant changes its machinery, the old machinery is abandoned and these gases, which are trapped in the radiators or whatever, are allowed to escape. And these are very, very harmful. So you have to enact laws, you have to prepare laws that would contain these gases. So it's a question of regulating the sectors. You have to do the necessary groundwork to prevent any shocks to industry, because you cannot afford that, because you cannot have a factory which has to sack its employees because it loses its market. So, you know, you have to do a lot of homework ahead so that you'll be able to a lot of preparatory work in order to assess what are the impacts of these laws and try to find legal ways and means how to do them. Just something else, it's not just laws that have to be made, but also policy instruments. You could have administrative practices like permitting, for example. So it works on both fronts.
Complex possibilities.
Yes, that's right.
Different possibilities. An issue that I was thinking about as well is that we can do wonderful things on our own island, but if there are ships moving through the Sicilian Channel, which with the prevailing northwesterly winds drive pollution onto our island, then it's not really our fault. Somebody has to police the shipping, really.
Exactly.
So, you know, that's a bit unfair for us, because we might look bad when really it's not us at all.
Exactly. In fact, I'm sure Elul mentioned this because it's one of his major concerns, and he's right. One of the issues that we will, as a result of the Paris Agreement, definitely, not only as a nation, but we are a major shipping nation, so we have to take it up ourselves, but even other states, targeting marine transport, for example. Marine transport generates a lot of emissions, not just greenhouse gases, but also other types of emissions. Some of these emissions are already regulated under protocols under the International Maritime Organization and what is known as MARPOL, a treaty that regulates shipping. But we need to really target emissions, greenhouse gas emissions from ships. The EU already targets emissions from the aviation sector, the civil aviation sector, but it does so on its own. Other states do not target, again, emissions from the aviation sector, which is also a great contributor to greenhouse gases from the transport sector. So what you need to have a level playing field. If you're going to target emissions from transport, you have to target all forms of transport, marine transport, you have to tackle trains, you have to tackle road transport, you know. So nothing should really remain out of the picture, and so on and so forth.
We've gone chatting about this for ages. You were at the Paris COP conference, so tell us a little bit about it, about the experience.
Well, it's quite a laborious task. First of all, Paris is just, it was the end. It was obviously the important ending. Without it, all the work done beforehand would have been futile. But in reality, what you had was in Paris was the fulfillment of a mandate that the members, the parties, you call them, of the conference of the United Nations Convention on Climate Change, what is known as the UNFCCC, meets every year to fulfill the obligations of the treaty that was concluded in 1992. However, this treaty had become a bit too wishy-washy for today's needs, and also for what the science has been telling us, that it's not definitely not enough. It was a start, but it's outdated. We needed to have more action. We had the Kyoto Protocol in 1997, but that also was in a way superseded. And so states, when they had met in Copenhagen, had tried to have a new agreement, but unfortunately, for a number of reasons, it collapsed, and the talks didn't materialize into pretty much anything. Then, after that, I think it was a huge shock even for the members of the UNFCCC. And although usually have all the negative repercussions from Copenhagen, but there was still the will to do something. And despite the divergences between the parties, from then on, there were other conferences held yearly, from Cancun in Mexico, then South Africa, and then later Doha and Lima in Peru. In between, each of these conferences was very important. Then when we came to the South African conference, we agreed on a mandate that by the year 2015, the conference of the parties of the year 2015 will have to produce a legally binding or an agreement with legal force, which will actually target the realities of climate change, how we should deal with climate change given the science that we have today. And this is what happened in Paris. We had a massive call for the heads of government to be present. In fact, about 150 were present. It was historical in that sense. And then an agreement, which was achieved. I would say it was even more than what we expected as an EU. It was really, really an achievement. And it's not a joke to achieve something amongst 195 states. So I think we're all very happy about it. I think it's the best Christmas present we could have given to the planet.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm sure I could ask you to come back again and tell us about the Paris conference, because it must have been an amazing experience.
We could do that. Even we could see what else the university could be doing now that we have the Paris Agreement, and it would be a pleasure.
Very good.
All the best to everybody. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being on the program, Professor Simone Borge.
You've been listening to University Matters on Campus FM. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.
Il-programm li għadkom kemm smajtu kien miġjub lilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.